Hello, welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I am reading from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is ew.com. Last week was a bit of an abbreviated show, and I still have some articles held over from then, so let's get started with a TV review of White Lotus. Season 3 gets off to a sleepy start. Mike White's Emmy-winning HBO anthology about dysfunctional rich people moves to Thailand in the third season. This is by Kristen Baldwin. Trigger warning. Literally. Season 3 of HBO's The White Lotus begins with what sounds like a mass shooting. A young man named Zion, played by Nicholas Duvernay, sits in an open-air patio over a lagoon at the White Lotus Resort and Spa in Thailand, where Amrita, played by Shalini Parias, a spa employee, is about to lead him through a meditation practice. They close their eyes, and for a moment, the pair are immersed in the gentle sounds of wind rustling through the jungle greenery. Then a gunshot, and another, and another, and another, and another, as the monkeys in the trees screech and guests and staff scramble for safety from the continuing gunfire, a body floats into frame face down. It's the first time creator Mike White has opened his lauded dramedy and mystery anthology series with the story's climactic act of violence, and the effect is both visceral and arresting. But once the action flashes back to a week earlier, the new season slows to an uncharacteristically languid pace. White spends the first several episodes introducing and reintroducing viewers to his latest group of wealth-weary guests and the preternaturally tolerant staff who dote on them, just when it seems like this hotel-based franchise might be getting a little run down, season 3 develops into an engrossing mystery about beautiful people who have everything they could ever want, but nothing they really need. By now, we know the archetypes who arrive via boat for a week of White Lotus luxury. This season's couple that shouldn't be is Rick, played by Walton Goggins, whose perpetual moodiness is only exacerbated by his free-spirited and much younger girlfriend, Chelsea, played by Amy Lou Wood. The Ratliffs of Durham, North Carolina, businessman Timothy, played by Jason Isaacs, his snobby wife Victoria, played by Parker Posey, and their kids, Saxon, played by Patrick Schwarzenegger, Lachlan, played by Sam Nivola, and Piper, played by Sarah Catherine Hook, are the barely functional family. Leading the gal pals looking for a good time charge are Jacqueline, played by Michelle Monaghan, a TV actress, and her longtime friends, Kate, played by Leslie Bibb, and Lori, played by Carrie Coon. Catering to this collection of needy vacationers are a cadre of unflappable staff. Sreetala, played by Lek Patravati, the regal visionary behind the White Lotus Spa, and wife of the hotel's owner, Jim Hollinger, played by Scott Glenn. Kai Tuck, played by Tammy Thatthem Thong, a sweet-natured security guard who's hopelessly in love with Mook, played by Lalisa Monobal, one of the hotel's quote-unquote health mentors, and Belinda, played by Natasha Rothwell, the put-upon spa manager from season 1, who is in Thailand as part of the resort chain's exchange program. This time, she gets to stay at the hotel as a guest while working alongside spa manager Porchai, played by Dom Hetrickul. It's been a rough couple of years, admits Belinda, who is still recovering from her misadventure with the late Tanya McQuaid. When this program opened up, it was a blessing. I think the universe knew I needed something. With its spacious suites overlooking lush jungles and turquoise ocean waters, the White Lotus Thailand is built for escape. But like guests in seasons past, the new characters can't break free of the torments, existential or otherwise, that they left back home. Timothy's vacation zen is almost instantly destroyed by the unwelcome news that a shady business deal from his past is about to surface in the press. Lachlan is caught between his older brother Saxon, the arrogant, status-obsessed womanizer who wants his little bro to follow in his footsteps, and his idealistic sister Piper, a budding Buddhist who is writing a thesis on a well-known Thai monk, Luang Por Tira, played by Suthi Chai Yoon. Chelsea regularly makes excuses for Rick's rude behavior, even as he refuses to tell her anything about the business he needs to attend to in Bangkok. And when they're not gushing about how great it is to finally spend real time together, Kate, Jacqueline, and Lori are breaking off into groups of two so they can vigorously trash-talk the third. Though these dynamics are clearly established by the end of episode one, White spends the first 3 hours reiterating his character's foibles. Rather than advancing the story, he pads the episodes with harbingers. The Ratliff's chipper valet, Pam, played by Morgana O'Reilly, warns the family that the fruit from the surrounding pong-pong trees is toxic. Gaitok's boss issues him a gun after a breach in security at the hotel jewelry store. A mishap at a local snake show convinces Chelsea that death is coming for her, Final Destination style. Belinda starts to have suspicions about one of the hotel's regulars, and Lachlan's newfound obsession with tsunamis gives Victoria nightmares. It all adds up to an ominous but obvious warning. Something bad is coming. But man, White Lotus looks as beautiful as ever. White, who once again serves as sole writer and director, adorns the episodes with vignettes highlighting the behind-the-scenes work that's required to keep a paradise looking perfect. A lone staffer raking leaves off a secluded beach. Another paddling across a glassy sea to adjust an overwater hammock in the golden light of dawn. And with a cast like this, it's perfectly pleasant to watch the characters soak in the vibes until things really start moving in episode 4. Sporting a series of baggy Hawaiian shirts and ever-present sunglasses, Goggins muffles his indelible charisma under Rick's shroud of defensive anger and melancholy. When Chelsea pressures him into a meditation session, Rick informs Amrita about his unhappy childhood with a mix of impatience and heartbreaking resignation. "I don't need to detach," he says. "I'm already nothing." Expectations and the prison of identity are themes that run throughout the new season. As the bad news continues to pour in, Timothy takes frantic and increasingly desperate measures to keep his family in the dark about the legal quagmire waiting for him in the States. Isaac portrays his character's intense panic over the impending public downfall so effectively, I felt it in my own gut. Jacqueline laments the pressures of celebrity life. "I can never have a bad day in public anymore." While Saxon's drunken night out with Lachlan, Chelsea and her friend Chloe, played by Charlotte Le Bon, threatens to implode his towering self-image. Even mild-mannered Gay Tuck must push himself to take action when the security office's gun goes missing. Thatham Thong, a former infantryman in the Royal Thai Army, is extraordinarily endearing as Gay Tuck, whose gentle courtship of Manabal's Mook provides a welcome island of humanity in White Lotus's sea of rich white malaise. Now that Belinda is experiencing a tiny taste of the good life, Rothwell is able to bring more comedy into her performance. You really know how to treat a burned-out bitch. Posey goes full comic relief with her loopy, snooty Victoria. The actress's take on a North Carolina drawl is an amusingly bizarre choice. Tim, is something going on? Sex Education's Wood is once again a standout as Chelsea, who tempers her piercing wit with a new age equanimity. Unfortunately, the incomparable Carrie Coon is underutilized as a divorced lawyer, Lori, but at least the Emmy-nominated actress got to ditch the Gilded Age's corsets and ball gowns for a few months in loose linens and swimsuits. And a guest star who must remain unnamed pops up later in the season to deliver an astonishing monologue on the psychological underpinnings of his character's sex addiction. After watching the 6 out of 8 episodes HBO made available for review, I'm only truly invested in seeing Rick's story through to the end. A late-season twist in Saxon and Lachlan's arc seems engineered specifically to cause an internet meltdown, but I choose to trust that White has a payoff planned. Amidst these reservations, though, I found myself noodling over multiple theories about the shooter and that body in the lagoon. In short, the White Lotus still works. Even when the storytelling lags, it's still impossible to check out early. The White Lotus premiered Sunday, February 16th, and it airs weekly at 10 p.m. Eastern Time and Pacific Time on HBO. That was the White Lotus review. Season 3 gets off to a sleepy start. It was by Kristen Baldwin. Another review from TV, Love is Blind, the most boring season yet. Season 8 of Netflix's hit dating show highlights 32 singles from Minneapolis. This is by Kristen Baldwin. The producers of Love is Blind certainly took a chance by setting season 8 in Minneapolis, given the regional phenomenon known as Minnesota Nice. According to this stereotype, people from the land of 10,000 lakes are known to be polite and friendly, but they also harbor an emotional reserve that can keep folks at a distance. Reality television is a genre built on big feelings, bigger personalities, and impassioned confrontations, so the qualities of Minnesota Nice don't really align with what casting directors usually look for in their contestants. Yet, Kinetic Content, the studio behind Netflix's hit dating series, forged ahead anyway, rounding up 32 single Minnesotans who were willing to look for love through a frosted glass wall. Alas, the Love is Blind producers, whose job it is to make their contestants, or employees, feel uncomfortable bearing their souls for millions of television viewers, were not up to the challenge. The result is the most boring season of Love is Blind to date, with couples whose romantic travails are about as spicy as macaroni salad. We interrupt this review for a necessary disclaimer. Of course, Minnesotans are not a monolith, and plenty of them have no trouble displaying their emotions. But having spent my formative childhood years in Wayzata, Minnesota, I can confirm that the Minnesota Nice characterization is not accurate. The season begins as they all do, with hosts Nick and Vanessa Lackey greeting the male and female contestants in their respective dorms before sending them into the pods to date. The initial small talk between couples is endearingly Minnesotan when Yemi, a 30-year-old product sales manager, tells a potential suitor that she's from Woodbury, Minnesota. He replies, "They have a beautiful Costco out there." Over the course of the 71-minute premiere, several main characters start to emerge. Madison, 28, is a discerning artist whose childhood trauma makes her reluctant to display vulnerability. Earnest basketball coach Devin, 29, is eager to build a family, and woo-woo nurse Meg, 31, rejects organized religion but believes in ghosts and aliens. Lauren, 31, is an educator with a gentle spirit, while Daniel, a 30-year-old sales account executive, continually tells us he's 5'8" and needs a woman looking for a short king. Dave, 33, is a tightly wound medical device salesman who masks his insecurities with quippy insults. "Why are you here? What's wrong with you?" and is the closest this season comes to a quote-unquote villain. It's worth noting that while season 8 boasts the largest cast to date, it's also very noticeably the whitest. Historically, Love is Blind casts are approximately 50% non-white. Here it drops to under 30%. While Minnesota is a majority white state, it's also well known for its large communities of Somali, Mexican, Hmong, and Native residents, among other minority groups, and it's disappointing that producers didn't reflect that in their casting. There's also a dearth of contestants to root for. Among a few standouts are 35-year-old Brittany and a funny and vivacious partnership executive who does not get nearly enough screen time, and Joey, a goofy 35-year-old physician associate with the platonic ideal of a Minnesota accent. Truly, future casts of Fargo should study him. Joey bonds quickly with Monica, an easygoing 28-year-old in digital marketing, and their silly, sweet courtship provides the season's most charming romance. Otherwise, the first 6 episodes are long on dull, meandering chants in the pods. It's not that all conversations are banal, though many are. Here's an example. I actually have a question. Do you like forts? But that's often the case in the early get-to-know-you phase of the pod process. What's puzzling is that even when the potential for interesting human drama is there, producers let it fizzle out rather than nurturing their contestants' candor. I don't think I've ever dated a nice guy in my entire life, notes Virginia, a 34-year-old healthcare recruiter, in one of her conversations with Devin. That sure seems like a rich emotional vein to mine, but she never brings it up again. Early in the season, Lauren grapples with the revelation that her top pick is also dating Molly, a 30-year-old executive assistant. But rather than confronting him outright, she mildly requests that he not tell her about his other dates. To be clear, I'm not suggesting that the Love and Blind producers break in over the PA system and order the couples to talk about specific subjects when they're in the pods. But it is a reality TV producer's job to engage in probing conversations with contestants that will nudge them toward more open and interesting for the viewer interactions with their fellow contestants. That does not seem to be happening here. When couples do tiptoe up to the edge of conflict, it can be compelling. Madison is forthright about her harrowing upbringing, much of which she spent taking care of parents who were struggling with addiction, and how it's led her to an avoidant attachment style. This is a trigger for the man she's dating, who says frankly, "I think that could lead to some issues." It's one of the most honest conversations we see in the first 6 episodes. And Sarah, a 29-year-old nurse who thinks it's important to speak out on social justice issues, has a fascinating and disheartening exchange with developer Ben, 28, about the murder of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer. "What are your thoughts on Black Lives Matter?" she asks. His response, "I just kind of keep out of it." If Love is Blind Season 8 has any scream-at-your-TV moments, this is it. Mostly, though, the new season had me checking my watch, playing the episodes at 1.5 times speed, and continually scrambling back through my notes to identify contestants. Wait, is that the white guy Mason, the 33-year-old cinematographer, or Alex, the 29-year-old commercial real estate broker? Even after watching the show for hours, things don't pick up much once the couples leave the pods. As they count down to their wedding day, the lovers grapple with the types of issues you'd expect: money management, domestic habits, family integration, and so on. Netflix made 9 out of 12 episodes available for review. So, like many Love is Blind couples before them, our Minnesota sweethearts follow the path of willful blindness on their way to the altar, confidently avoiding their relationship's obvious red flags. I can see this love lasting a lifetime, one smitten woman tells her fiancé. A lifetime? Bless her optimism. This love could barely hold my attention for an hour. The first 6 episodes of Love is Blind Season 8 are streaming now on Netflix. That was the review of Love is Blind, the most boring season yet. It was by Kristen Baldwin, and she's giving this season, so far, a grade of D. Another article from the movie section is how the James Bond shift at Amazon could shake up, not stir, the long-running franchise. With the Broccoli family ceding creative control to Amazon MGM Studios, 007 is destined for new horizons. This is by Maureen Lee Linker. Bond. James Bond. They're familiar words to moviegoers around the world, but the James Bond franchise may be reintroducing itself in an entirely new way in the future. On Thursday, Amazon MGM Studios, Michael G. Wilson, and Barbara Broccoli announced a new joint venture to house the intellectual property rights of James Bond, ceding creative control of the franchise to Amazon MGM after over 60 years under the watchful eye of the Broccoli family. Wilson and Broccoli will remain co-owners of the Bond series, but step back from creative management. The franchise first launched in 1962, shepherded by Albert Cubby Broccoli of Eon Productions, the British production company that had overseen all Bond films until today's announcement. Barbara and I agree it's time for our trusted partner, Amazon MGM Studios, to lead James Bond into the future, Wilson said in a statement. It's a change with implications as powerful as a new bit of tech from Q. Unlike Marvel or Star Wars or even the Muppets, which have spent a decade or more under the umbrella of a Hollywood studio's control, the Bond films have remained an outlier with the Broccoli family's resolute stewardship. Though they have maintained a lengthy distribution and producing relationship with MGM, they always closely guarded their intellectual property. Under their guidance, 25 Bond films have been produced to date. All adhere to some general rules, including that Bond must be played by an actor of British or Commonwealth heritage. Other hallmarks include the evolving tradition of the Bond girl, largely bloodless violence, and more. Some of this will undoubtedly remain the same. Can you imagine a James Bond film without the signature gun barrel title sequence? But in the name of fostering their legacy, the Broccoli family has kept a tight leash on Bond films, one that will be slackened substantially when this transaction is complete. Until now, Bond has only been permitted to exist in feature films, but with Amazon MGM taking the reins, it's likely Bond will go the way of other franchises in this age. With Prime Video available as a platform, there's a universe in which we'll get a James Bond TV show on streaming. And while the films have traditionally built upon their own mythology, occasionally resetting with new actors, there's now nothing to prevent Amazon MGM Studios from greenlighting prequels and spin-offs previously off the table. This is both exciting and concerning. While the notion of a sitcom about Q's lab hijinks or a prequel centered on Moneypenny's origins has potential, it could also end up diluting the brand, as has been the case with the glut of Star Wars and Marvel titles that has led Disney to scale back their output for both franchises significantly. There's also the possibility that James Bond films will cease to be a cinematic event. If the world of Bond extends beyond a feature film every few years, it expands the world and oversaturates the market. Though the Bond films have worked hard to evolve for modern times, some point to its traditionalism as an obstacle. Perhaps this change in creative control could clear the way for various Bonds of different ethnicities, gender identities, sexualities, etc. It's an update to the franchise that audiences have long been asking for, and there's more space for it than ever. Though we'd like to make the plea that Bond remains solely in the hands of British Commonwealth thespians. Personally, I'd love to see them dip into Bond's roots and produce some period pieces, returning the character to creator and novelist Ian Fleming's inspirations in World War II, or Bond's beginning in the swinging 60s. Additionally, while the Daniel Craig films introduced a new degree of grit and engagement with the real world, they also had a clear mission to make Bond a serious movie endeavor rather than a franchise that's just fun to watch. Without his keeper striving to define and preserve his legacy above all else, there's space for both a prestige Bond and a playful Bond. All of this being said, one does wonder about the intentions of Bond's new creative architects. Amazon and all of its attendant properties is owned by Jeff Bezos, who has proven in recent months to have no issue kowtowing to authoritarians for the sake of his bottom line. That's not very Bond-like. In fact, it's behavior in the realm of a Bond villain. He even bears a striking resemblance to Ernst Blofeld, as portrayed by Donald Pleasance and Telly Savalas. It's possible Bezos will have little involvement, but he did post on social media only hours after the announcement asking who people think should be the next Bond. Instead of using this opportunity to make Bond a more inclusive franchise, Bezos could very well lean into the franchise's outmoded machismo, returning Bond to an aggressive womanizer and pillar of a brand of masculinity that aligns with the values of the far right. Bond may have been mired in traditionalism, but Broccoli and Wilson also strove to ensure he reflected our times back to us via the crises, anxieties, and criminal masterminds he faced. His impeccably tailored suits, predilection for shaken martinis, and cool head have stood as tried and true comforts in an ever more complicated and chaotic world. Sure, the franchise could do with some fresh thinking, but what happens when you hand James Bond over to a man who has more in common with the likes of Le Chiffre and Goldfinger? In the best case, this handoff of creative control will expand the world and possibilities of what can be defined as a James Bond property, but the worst-case scenario? That would be Bond becoming a tool of the villains he spent his fictional life defeating. In that case, Mr. Bond, we expect you to die. That was how the James Bond shift at Amazon could shake up, not stir, the long-running franchise, and it was by Maureen Lee Lanker. Here's a moment in between stories where I'll remind everybody that we are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly, and I'm reading from their website, EW.com. This is something that was from the year wrap-up that I don't think that we got to. It was from the books section. It's a roundup of the 10 reads that made us swoon the hardest this year. It's the 10 best romance novels of 2024, and it's also by Maureen Lee Lanker. We could all use a little more love in our lives, and 2024 was no exception. Whether or not you're currently wrapped up in a romance in real life, there were hundreds of great new love stories to fall for throughout the year. Some were spicy, others sweet, some modern, others taking us into the annals of the past. But the one thing they all had in common, they made us swoon. Here, in no particular order, are the 10 best romance novels of 2024. The first one, When I Think of You, by Maya Ariel. With her debut novel, Maya Ariel proves she can deliver all the feels and angst while still honoring the sacred romance Happily Ever After, otherwise known as HEA. Inspired by Ariel's own experiences working in the entertainment industry, When I Think of You follows Kalia Wilson, a studio receptionist who has more than paid her dues. She may finally get her chance thanks to up-and-coming director Danny Prescott, except for the fact that 7 years ago their college romance went up in smoke. Kalia has to decide whether it's worth it to risk it all for her dream career, and maybe even a love she never should have let go. The ins and outs of the film industry, as well as rampant casual and blatant racism, are cataloged in precise detail with an insider's eye. But it's the way that Danny's own personal story of his parents' interracial romance fuels his passion for his work and for Kalia that makes this slow-burn love story truly ignite. We savored this cinematic romance until the very last reel. That was When I Think of You by Maya Ariel. Hot Hex Boyfriend by Carly Bloom. 2024 saw witchy romance continue to enchant more and more readers, and Hot Hex Boyfriend was our particular standout amongst the supernatural titles. Delia Merriweather has never really believed her family's claim that they are witches, until she breaks a decades-old hex and unleashes her potent powers. Too bad that her attractive new next-door neighbor, Max, is secretly there with the intent of restoring the curse that was limiting her family. But as Max and Delia warm to each other, they uncover long-hidden secrets about those in charge of the witchy world. Amidst plenty of frothy fun, Bloom also offers readers a touching missive on embracing one's true identity and owning one's power. Because witches get S done. That's Hot Hex Boyfriend by Carly Bloom. Wake Me Most Wickedly by Felicia Grossman. With this Snow White redux, Felicia Grossman once again uses fairy tale retellings to upend caricature and unpack stereotypes in Wake Me Most Wickedly. Pawn shop owner Hannah can only see herself as a villain in the life of Solomon Weiss, a hard-working, respectable young man intent on making good for the brother who raised him. But with this adventurous yarn of black alley deals and rooftop escapes, Grossman challenges the narrative of the Jewish pawnbroker in history, illustrating how prejudice marginalized and villainized an entire group of people. Hannah and Saul can't deny the attraction between them, even if it stands in opposition to what they view as necessary to protect their siblings. But it is only once they can break through their own skewed perceptions of themselves that they can understand who is truly the fairest one of all, and reclaim a historic happy ending previously limited to Gentiles. That is Wake Me Most Wickedly by Felicia Grossman. The Love of My Afterlife by Christy Greenwood. The Love of My Afterlife gives new meaning to the trope of second chance romance with its tale of a woman given a new lease on life. When Delphi dies choking on a burger, she ends up meeting Jonah, the man whom she believes is her soulmate in the afterlife waiting room. So she's sent back to Earth with a task. Find Jonah and get him to kiss her within the next 10 days or return to the afterlife. But in her mad dash to find her supposed lovemate, Delphi learns a valuable lesson about the difference between existing and truly living. Greenwood's novel is a heartfelt tribute to the power of community and the need for compassion, friendship, and connection in all of our lives. It's a love story, yes, but also a soul-renewing reminder that the meaning of life comes from those who we choose to share it with. That's The Love of My Afterlife by Kirsty Greenwood. Best Hex Ever by Nadia Elfassi. Nadia Elfassi also crafted a standout witchy love story with Best Hex Ever, a novel that cranks up the cauldron fire in its love scenes. Though Dina Whitlock is a talented witch with the ability to charm pastries and beverages in her coffee shop to bestow good moods upon her customers, she can't untangle her love life, and the hex that ensures anyone who falls for her will get hurt. Dina is bisexual, offering readers a powerful message of self-love in the ways that her openness about her sexual identity impinges upon her magic. The book is a feminist, full-hearted ode to a woman's power and the vulnerability it takes to open one's heart. That is Best Hex Ever by Nadia Elfassi. Kiss Countdown by Etta Easton. We're a sucker for the fake dating story, and Etta Easton delivers one that's out of this world with the Kiss Countdown. After event planner Amory Price loses her job, she knows it's only a matter of time before she's out of a place to live, too. But a chance meeting with astronaut Vincent Rogers gives her an out. She can live in his apartment rent-free if she pretends to be his girlfriend at family events. Of course, soon their charade becomes all too real, and their chemistry gives off sparks. But Emery has to make peace with her chronic people-pleasing while Vincent copes with familial expectations and pressures. Easton offers readers a delightful rom-com that is both an enchanting escape and a celebration of unexpected connection and the value of family. That's The Kiss Countdown by Etta Easton. Don't Want You Like a Best Friend by Emma R. Albin. Emma R. Albin is a playful, whimsical, vibrant addition to the world of historical romance. Victorian ladies Beth Demerovin and Gwen Haffenfort conspire to parent-trap their widowed parents into a romance, all the while falling for each other. Beth has only one season to land a husband who will ensure that her family can avoid certain destitution, but the wild, carousing Gwen is the answer to a prayer as she concocts a plot to pair her rakish Earl father with Beth's mother. Their plan goes awry as they are increasingly weighed down by heaps of romantic angst and yearning for each other. With Don't Want You Like a Best Friend, Albin crafts a deliciously fun rom-com that grants space and a historically viable ending to its queer protagonists, earning her work an instant spot on our keeper shelf. The Other Side of Disappearing by Kate Claiborne. Kate Claiborne often finds her way onto this list, but it's because her ability to capture emotional poignancy and the dignity of her everyday characters is unparalleled. Romance, frankly, can be classist, given that social mobility and wealth are a time-honored trope of the genre and its wish fulfillment. But Claiborne often throws that out the window, as she does here with hairdresser Jess Green and corn-fed podcast producer Adam Hawkins. Jess has spent the last 10 years raising her half-sister, Tegan, only to have her life upended when Adam and his boss show up to untangle the true story of their mother's disappearance. It's a riveting mystery and a soberingly honest look at the trauma of abandonment. But most of all, it's an open-hearted ode to the tiny ways a person can sneak into another's heart. The Other Side of Disappearing makes the little things the big things with its soulful examination of the value of emotional boundaries and when to let someone in. That's The Other Side of Disappearing by Kate Claiborne. The Mistress Experience by Scarlett Peckham. Scarlett Peckham writes radical heroines who dare to blaze their own trail, and Thais Magdalene, a renowned courtesan and champion of women's rights, is no exception. After Lord Alistair Eden wins a month of Thais's company in an auction, she's shipped off to a country cottage only to discover that he's wrestling with sexual dysfunction. Peckham writes empathetically of Eden's challenges, as well as crafting the details of Thais's profession and expertise with a blissfully compassionate lack of judgment. Her willingness to tackle these perhaps less quote-unquote romantic aspects of intimacy makes Peckham essential to the romance canon, pushing the boundaries of how we define happiness, sexual fantasy, and character growth. But above all, The Mistress Experience is an ode to a softer kind of love, a reminder that sometimes just opening your heart to another is the most revolutionary act one can take. That's The Mistress Experience by Charlotte Peckham. And our last book on the list, Say You'll Be Mine by Nanina Kumar. Nandini Kumar puts her own rom-com twist on the arranged marriage plot with this modern tale. When Meghna Raman agrees to meet potential suitor Karthik Murthy, she's pleased to discover that neither of them are interested in the marriage their parents have schemed up, which is how they end up faking an engagement to keep their parents happy and provide Meghna with a date to the wedding of her best friend and longtime crush. Yet, the more time they spend together, the more they come to admire their quirks, understand their familial wounds, and embrace their chemistry. Say You'll Be Mine crackles with wit, injecting Kumar's cultural identity and experiences into the rom-com genre for a book that teaches readers to avoid the pitfalls of preconceptions and external expectations. That's Say You'll Be Mine by Naina Kumar. And that's the big list from the end of 2024 of the 10 best romance novels of last year. Maureen Lee Lanker reads a lot of romance novels. I'm sure that we'll have a list for spring as well. And last weekend was Saturday Night Live's 50th anniversary, and these are the best and worst moments from the Saturday Night Live 50th anniversary special. In a night filled with nostalgia and humor, there was plenty to love and a little to loathe about SNL 50. This is by Andy Hoagland. Saturday Night Live's 50th anniversary is one of this year's milestone celebrations, marked by decades of iconic sketches, unforgettable musical performances, and a host of legendary guest appearances. Sunday's event brought together beloved cast members from past and present, a culmination of the show's enduring influence on comedy and pop culture. It was, in other words, the ultimate victory lap, a night packed with nostalgia, humor, and surprise moments. Here are the best and worst moments from SNL 50, the anniversary special. And number one of 20, the best SNL lore. From the opening moments featuring the likes of Paul Simon and Steve Martin, SNL 50 sought to weave in legends from the show's early years, including an opening montage featuring cast photos from different SNL eras. In his monologue, Martin also gave a nod to the show's writers, featuring a cutaway to a few familiar faces, including Jim Downey and Robert Smigel. He was later joined on stage by former SNL cast member Martin Short and former SNL writer John Mulaney, which made for a nice blend of generations. Our second item is a worst, corporate brand synergy. During the show's NYC musical sketch, John Mulaney lamented the decline of the New York arts and music scenes, noting that the city is a bunch of TD banks. A good point, but one at odds with the messaging in the lead-up to the anniversary special, which was littered with cross-pollinated brand messaging. Once upon a time, Lorne Michaels frowned on his stars cozying up to high-profile commercial work out of a concern it would undercut their role as satirists. Today, it's a different story. During the SNL 50, Red Carpet Special and Beyond, we were treated to an Allstate commercial with the Please Don't Destroy the Crew, Capital One ads via Anna Gasteyer and Molly Shannon's Delicious Dish revival, a T-Mobile rap featuring Kenan Thompson and Marcelo Hernandez. But that's not all. There was Maybelline's red carpet sponsorship and new ad campaign with Cecily Strong and Vanessa Bayer, Bowen Yang and Sarah Sherman going full metal in a new campaign for CeraVe, and Volkswagen debuted a new commercial featuring the Californians characters. Everyone's got to make a living, but it was too much. Number three is a best, Black Jeopardy cameos. In the Black Jeopardy sketch, one of the night's surprises was seeing Tracy Morgan as one of the show's contestants. And, as a rival participant, the legendary Eddie Murphy as Morgan. Showtime at the Apollo and In Living Color references were the icing on the cake. Next up, Tom Hanks returned as MAGA voter Doug, who previously appeared on the segment. A worst, broadly named montages. Maybe SNL 40 said it best when it comes to succinctly honoring the show's best moments. In a long, curious pre-tape, genuinely classic moments were interspersed with modern hackery. When your thesis statement lets you pack in practically anything, from Chevy Chase pratfalls to Love's a Dream to forgettable recent scenes like Chris Rock's surgeon being sprayed with blood by Adam Sandler, maybe just call your segment montage. Best was a Deep Thoughts by Jack Handy. Deep Thoughts by Jack Handy was a segment on SNL consisting of surreal one-liner jokes written and orated by the former SNL writer that aired in the 90s. So hearing the music that Phil Hartman voiceover and Handy's demure narration during the anniversary show really took us back. It was easily one of the night's best surprises. Another best, Adam Driver's face. After Julia Louis-Dreyfus explained that her emotional support dog took John Lovitz's seat in 8H, the Veep star turned her attention to Adam Driver's steely, stoic gaze, which she claimed masked his attraction to her. Iconic! Another best, Aubrey Plaza. Aubrey Plaza has been laying low since the tragic death of her husband, Jeff Baena, who died by suicide on January 3rd, so it was moving to see her introduce Miley Cyrus and Brittany Howard's cover of Prince's Nothing Compares to You. A worst was show hypocrisy. Speaking of Nothing Compares to You, the show honored a track famously performed on SNL by Sinead O'Connor, who died in 2023. Famously, the show cut O'Connor loose after she ripped up a picture of the Pope in protest of the church's child sex abuse scandals. Another best, drunk update couple. The girl you wish you hadn't started a conversation with at a party, played by Cecily Strong, announced she's having a baby with drunk uncle, played by Bobby Moynihan. It was fun to see Moynihan riff on the show history. One qualm, no drunk girl? A worst Canadian update couple. I love Vanessa Bayer, but did not need to see the Lorne Michaels best friends from growing up characters at the anniversary show. Instead, we needed Oscar winner Howard Shore here, who actually grew up with Lorne. Another best, Bill Murray ranks Weekend Update hosts. On Friday, Bill Murray performed as Nick the Lounge Singer during the homecoming concert. On SNL 50, his anchor correspondent returned to list his favorite update hosts. Beyond the classy tribute to Norm MacDonald, Bill's shout-out to his own brother, Brian Doyle Murray, was amazing. Gail Mathias was snubbed. And for the record, Brian Doyle Murray was the number one on his list. Another best, self-aware in-jokes. At times, the show displayed surprising self-awareness. Andy Samberg's digital short on SNL's long history of anxiety was incisive and smart, and featured a fun rapping cameo from Chris Parnell. Meanwhile, when Ryan Reynolds raised his hand during the Q&A segment with Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, Fey asked him, "How's it going?" poking fun at the legal battle and PR nightmare he and his wife, Blake Lively, are currently dealing with, the actor quipped, "Why? What have you heard?" Number 13 on our list is a worst, diminishing returns on the Mulaney musical. I will accept the return of Kate McKinnon's alien abductee character, Colleen Rafferty, but her Rudy Giuliani was a huge miss to me during the 50th anniversary celebration. And for that matter, the John Mulaney musical Ode to New York City does not compare to its original iteration, Lobster Dinner. There is a legacy around NYC that needs to be grappled with, but I'm not sure musical theater is the answer. For one thing, Lin-Manuel Miranda just revisited Hamilton on SNL a mere month ago. However, it was cool seeing Paul Schaefer and guitarist G.E. Smith back. Best, the return of Chad and Lorraine Newman. Lorraine Newman reminiscing about the original Not Ready for Primetime Players years was very moving, but also funny as her trips down memory lane were undercut by Pete Davidson's thoughtless dope Chad. Gilda Radner is gone, John Belushi is gone. Seeing Lorraine hold the torch for them was fantastic, as was seeing her and fellow original cast member Jane Curtin hold up a photo of Gilda during the good nights of the 50th anniversary special. Another best, Adam Sandler's 50 years performance. Elsewhere, Adam Sandler paid tribute to the show's many memories and team members, including its hardworking crew. He stole the show here, and was introduced by Jack Nicholson, who was making a rare public appearance. I will never say a bad word about something that name-drops Tim Kaczynski. Another worst, iconic Will Ferrell character usage. The commercial parody montage was a reminder of how hilarious Will Ferrell was during his time on the show, and how wasted he was wedged into the inexplicably placed Lawrence Welk show segment. He has a deep bench of characters, so I'm not sure SNL 50 made the right call tapping his Robert Goulet. However, he does conduct himself later on with his elf-referencing Scared Straight appearance. Another best, Mike Myers as Linda Richman. The Bronx Beat sketch with Amy Poehler and Maya Rudolph was perfectly fine, but immediately was elevated when Mike Myers' Linda Richman showed up. It was the first appearance of the Coffee Talk host since Myers hosted SNL back in 1997, and Richman's random cameo recalled the famous moment when Barbara Streisand guest starred in the sketch back in 1992. This was cool. Plus, we got a Paul Baldwin reference. In 2025, in this economy, we are spoiled. Feast on this, friends. Another best, Garrett Morris introduces Don't Look Back in Anger. After uneven returns from Debbie Downer and Scared Straight, the show regained its footing by having Garrett Morris introduce Tom Schiller's brilliant short film, Don't Look Back in Anger. Another best, Tom Hanks's In Memoriam. Tom Hanks took a moment to honor those countless members of the SNL family taken from us too soon. He wasn't speaking of late cast members, but SNL characters and sketches that have aged horribly as they featured ethnic stereotypes, sexual harassment, body shaming, animal cruelty, questionable makeup, slut shaming, sexism, and Adrian Brody in an ethnic wig, to name a few. Infamous sketches like Uncle Roy and Canteen Boy were called out. Did I miss It's Pat? But ultimately, as Hanks pointed out, the audience is at fault. You all laughed at them, so if anyone should be canceled, shouldn't it be you, the audience? And our 20 of 20 best, Lil Wayne's musical medley. No disrespect to Sir Paul McCartney, but Dwayne Carter Jr., a.k.a. Lil Wayne, clearly had the superior musical medley of the night. Backed by The Roots, the rapper performed hits including Uproar, Lollipop, 6 Foot, 7 Foot, Mrs. Officer, and Amelie. Fun fact, Wayne first appeared on the show back in 2004 when he was featured in Destiny's Child performance of Soldier. That was our best and worst moments from the Saturday Night Live 50th anniversary special, and it was by Andy Hoagland. That about wraps up the time we have for Entertainment Weekly this week. You know, if you ever want to listen to a replay of this or any of the other shows, you can always go to the website, which is sunsounds.org. Just click on the broadcast info and audio button that's just below the donate button, And there you'll see a list of programming links on the left-hand side. You can listen live to what's ever playing in the moment. You can see the broadcast schedule, or you can go to on-demand broadcasts. If you click on-demand broadcasts, then you'll have a list of recent shows. Usually it's 2 or 3 weeks worth, and it's broken out by category. So in this instance, you could go to the entertainment category and re-listen to Entertainment Weekly. We also have an app, which is very exciting, and you can download that for your phone or portable device, like a tablet or something, wherever you normally download an app from. That is SunSounds. That's all you need to search for, and you can get the app, and you're able to play current shows that are going on right now, or go back just like you can from the website and listen to past shows. At any rate, that wraps us up for Entertainment Weekly this week. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on SunSounds of Arizona. Come back next week, and we'll go over the latest from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. Until then, thanks for listening. Goodbye.